everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today I am joined by my friends, Jeff Harmon and Nick Page. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey, well, we got a lot of feedback from listeners of the podcasts. This last week, we did a survey and heard kind of the things that you all like about the podcast and that you don't like about the podcast. Thank you all for taking the time to do that. Definitely helped us. There are going to be some pretty big changes coming to this podcast and the others on the Improved Photography Network coming in January based on your feedback. So thank you for doing that. And it's just going to make our show even better in the coming year. And today we are going to do an all Q&A episode because we want to keep it as real as possible. So let's dive right into the photography topics. And Nick, you have the first question.
All right. So I got an email from Matt, and he says, I recently got all of my gear stolen, which is a terrible email to get. But anyways, he got all his gear stolen. He's in the process of replacing and upgrading his gear. He has a 7D Mark II kit lens, Tamron 10-24, Rokinon 35mm, and he wants to do night photography. What are our thoughts on which lens he should get? I have talked about this before. The Rokinon 24mm f1.4 is like the lens, in my opinion, for night photography, although there's kind of a new player in the game, and that is the Sigma 20mm 1.4. That is a really compelling lens that I can't wait to try someday. The question is if it's going to suffer from the really bad coma distortion that the 24mm version of that lens struggles with. So I'm excited to try that lens, but right now the answer has to be a Rokinon 24mm manual focus f1.4.
Very good recommendation. So I have a question. I keep hearing things about coma that photographers are really annoyed with coma. So first, let me just say what it is in case somebody hasn't heard of it. Coma just means that when you're taking, especially, I mean, it's really a picture of anything, but it really comes out with pictures of stars, that things around the very edges of the picture just kind of look oblong. Mm-hmm. And so a star in the very corners of the picture will look like a very short streak instead of a nice dot of a star. And so that's what coma is. Now, I really just don't care about it. I've received a few comments from listeners saying, you know, that I recommend the Fuji 16mm, which is basically the same as the lens that you're recommending, Nick, just in Fuji world. And they say, well, how could you recommend that? It has bad coma distortion. And I always think, you know, that takes like half a second to get rid of. And I it's just not something that I really worry about that much. Is that a real problem for you, or is it just one more thing to do?
It varies from lens to lens. Like, some lenses are really, really bad at it. Like, I had the Canon 24mm f1.4, really expensive lens, and the coma distortion was really, really noticeable. And the reason it's noticeable is because it happens in a very easily distinguishable, that's a terrible way of saying that word, a very easily seen pattern. It's like this in this circular pattern that is just, it just stands out really, really bad. But other lenses, like even the Canon 16-35, it suffers from it a little bit in the corners as well, but it doesn't happen in a really obvious pattern. And I think it's a lens by lens basis. That 16mm that you're talking about, I've seen pictures from it. It's not bad. It's not terrible with the distortion, but the Canon 24mm, it's terrible, like really bad coma distortion. So it all varies. It depends from lens to lens.
Okay, so maybe I just haven't seen it on a lens where it's really bad, because every time I see people complaining about that, I was saying, it's like this tiniest little thing. It's just the last of my concerns. Maybe that's the problem, though.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I have a question from James Ryan Jr., who asked, basically, he's trying to shoot with the gray card, and I can't get the camera to focus because he's focusing on the gray card. And for some reason, the camera won't focus when he's on the gray card, but when he focuses next to the gray card, it focuses just fine. Well, the reason the camera is doing this is because the camera needs contrast to focus. Always the camera needs some amount of contrast to focus. It's worse with contrast detection autofocus, but even with phase detection autofocus, the camera does need some amount of contrast to do its job. And so when you're focusing on a gray card, well, it's just a sheet of gray. There's no contrast. It's all one tone. And so the camera really won't focus. And so you're going to have to focus on something next to it, get the focus, and then you'll take the picture of the gray card. It really doesn't matter if the gray card is in perfect focus or not, because later we can just click it in Lightroom with the little dropper, and you're going to be just fine. As long as the gray card isn't way out of focus, because remember, when something's out of focus, it means things beside that item are blending into it. You know, we're having two objects melded together, and that's why it looks out of focus. And if you do that, it's going to mess up the color. So as long as it's pretty close to in focus, you're going to be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing to add to that would be if it's not where you're shooting, if you're going to use a gray card, you need to use it where you're shooting. The light could be different from there versus a few feet in front of it, especially if you're outdoors. And so if it's not able to focus on that and your subject is further back, that could be a problem. You need to get the card where you're going to actually take the shot and then get it out of the shot so you can take your photo and actually use it the way it's intended.
Right. When Jim is using gray cards, because he uses them all the time, he loves gray cards.
Now, I was nice. I didn't mention anything about the gray card. You got to bring it up.
But you raise an interesting point about needing to find contrast. There's a lot of situations that I'm shooting in, like at weddings when the light starts dropping, that I have to purposely seek out a point of contrast just so my camera can focus. Like, if this is kind of a quick tip, if you're in a really dark shooting situation, say you have a dance floor in front of you, you have to find the areas of contrast. Like, if the light is coming from the side, you have to put your focus point right on the edge of where that light's hitting the person, and then bam, suddenly it can find focus. So looking for points of focus dramatically helps your focusing, especially in low light or low contrast situations.
All right. I have a question now from David Munderlow, and he asks, is Windows 10 okay to install now? I hope my Lightroom 5 will be okay on it. Perhaps I'm just being nervous, but a couple of months ago, Jeff Harmon, me, mentioned to hold off. Perhaps the time is right now. And my answer is yes, it is time. I am fully comfortable now saying that it is approved for use. And Mac OS 10 El Capitan also approved for use. In fact, both of them, Microsoft and Apple, dropped new patches to their latest upgrades of the operating systems this last week. And both of them have fixed a whole bunch of bugs. And I am not seeing any more complaints from anyone on the forums or anything related to those updated operating systems. And they are good to go, with two exceptions. One is, if you use a Wacom tablet, you don't want to upgrade to Windows 10. The tablets still do not have device drivers that actually work on Windows 10.
That's kind of surprising from Wacom.
And the other one is Nikon tethering. If you do Nikon tethering, no El Capitan for you. They still don't support it. It's still got something wrong there, and it has not been fixed. So if that's important to you, if you need to tether your Nikon, you don't want El Capitan. Other than that, I think you're good to go. I think you can go and upgrade. And again, I recommend you don't do it like in the morning when you were planning to do an editing session in the afternoon or something like that. Give yourself a weekend, a few days. You may run into a few bumps or something and have to kind of work through it. But for the most part, I expect you're going to have a pretty smooth experience at this point.
Very good. Well, I got a question from Corey Smith, posted in the Tripod group. He said he's really enjoying the Tripod podcast, which is the new podcast that I'm doing with Nick Page and Majid Batizadegan. If you're interested in any kind of nature photography at all, go check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's been getting really good reviews on Amazon, or on iTunes, that we're really grateful for. Corey said that he wants to make his photos available for printing on his website, and he wants to have three sizes that people can pick from, and also three different types of media. And it just kind of asks what sizes and media types are the most common that he should make available for his prints. Well, if you want to do it this way, I think that you're going to have to choose some pretty standardized types of printing. For example, if you can't print on metal the same sizes as you can on canvas. And so if we only get three sizes and three different types of media that we can print on, metal should not be one of the options, because you just can't print that humongous. You can make some fairly decent sized metal prints, but not as big as a canvas. At least I haven't seen anybody that's making available metal prints that are as big as canvas. Maybe they're out there and I just haven't seen them though. So if we're going to you know, stick with kind of the traditional mediums, maybe pick two different types of paper and a canvas gallery wrap, I would say are probably the most common print types. And then for different sizes, I think this has a big impact on what your sales are going to be psychologically. Kind of what I've always been taught with pricing and what seems to have worked for me is when you have different levels of things, to make one, to make your least expensive option very inexpensive, kind of as the price leader. So, you know, when you see an advertisement for a, you know, a certain car, well, that's the one that has no features. Like they barely even include seats in it, right? Like they just rip everything out and that's their price leader. And so make one that's a very small size, you know, maybe an 8x10, something very small that really nobody's going to want, but is a low price. So that if somebody's just dying to get your picture and they don't have much money, that's an option for them. But then you really push somebody to the middle option that's just a little bit more expensive and is a nice, decent size. Maybe something like a 20x30. And then have one that's really, really big wall size that you can charge a significant premium for. And you know, maybe that's your 40x60 or something like that, 40 inches by 60 inches. I'm sorry, I don't know all those in the metric system. But that's kind of how I like to do anything when I'm pricing kind of three tiers, one really cheap that's very tiny, one middle that we expect most people to buy from, and then a big one that's at a significant premium. Nick, you sell more prints than I do. What do you do?
You know, most of my print sales are custom orders. And a lot of my prints are weird aspect ratios. So I'm doing lots of like 2-to-1 aspect ratios or 16x9. And that dramatically affects the sizes that I can do, because not every print lab can do a custom size of every single type of medium. So really, as far as the most popular sizes, something in the 16 to 24, 20 to 30, those are the most popular sales because people feel like they're getting a large print, yet it's not so large that they can't afford it. So that's kind of right. The most popular size range, and really most popular print surfaces, it's metal and canvas for me. Like I really don't do much of anything on paper.
Because you got to make the frame, and right. The frame's expensive.
Yeah, I don't want any part of that dealing with those frames. It's way expensive, and it's kind of a personal choice. And I don't want... I like being able to market it as ready to hang, because people are lazy and they don't want to deal with taking it down to the framing shop for a month while they wait for it. So I sell a lot more metal and canvas.
Very cool. Well, we have lots more questions to talk about, but we want to take a minute and thank Creative Live for sponsoring Improved Photography. This is the first time they've sponsored Improved Photography, and we really appreciate their support. You guys know Creative Live. Creative Live is an absolutely incredible way to learn, well, just about anything, but especially if you're a creative. They have tons and tons of classes that you can purchase or watch live on all different types of photography and media and business. And they have, I mean, just the absolute industry experts on all kinds of topics. They have classes from Tim Ferriss, Ann Geddes, Alex Bloomberg. I mean, it's the A-list of experts on Creative Live. And so, you know, no matter what you want to do, if you want to just get a little new spark in your photography and want to learn a couple new techniques, check it out at Creative Live. Very good place to go. If you want to add design to your skills or crafting, you want to learn music production, which is something that I've been working at and getting the audio on these podcasts produced just right. Or if you want to increase your business savvy and start your photography business a little bit better, then Creative Live is a great place to go. You can start at creativelive.com/improve, and that'll give you 20% off any of Creative Live's classes. That's creativelive.com/improve, and that'll give you 20% off any of Creative Live's classes. And so, thrill yourself. Go join a big group of scrappy and lively creators at creativelive.com. And we thank them for supporting the Improved Photography Podcast. All right. We have lots more questions that have rolled in from listeners. I think, Jeff, are you up?
Sure. I got one. This is from Marco Vergara. And he said that he's loving the show and he'd like to hear, this was a photo taco question, an episode on lens hoods. And I thought I'd bring it over to this podcast because I don't think we've really ever talked much about lens hoods and whether or not you guys like them and think they're valuable. So I'll give my opinion and I'd like to hear from both of you too. Mm-hmm. I think that lens hood's biggest advantage is protecting your lens so that when it falls over, you have a lens hood that could get damaged instead of hitting the lens. It helps on lens flare. It helps to kind of prevent some distortions a little bit. It can help with that. But the cases where it helps, I think, are so rare. I don't think there's a massive advantage to having it on or not, other than like the protection factor, like I talked about. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I totally agree. Leaving it on for me is a nice way of being lazy, so I don't have to put the lens cap on all the time. I can just throw it in my bag, not worry about it, and forget to put the lens cap on. It's okay because I lose my lens caps often enough. I don't typically lose my lens hoods. Another really useful thing is when you're doing landscape photography, it's really nice to have those on so the rain or mist or if there's anything like that floating around, it minimizes how much of that gets on the lens. So that's a useful use for a lens hood. But really, as far as like actually doing their job and minimizing lens flare, it does its job, but it's not often enough that you even need that. A lot of times when you're doing portraits and stuff, you want the lens flare anyways. So there's times that I purposely take mine off when I'm doing portraits just so I can get a little bit more lens flare, a little bit more creative glow and stuff in the corners and stuff. How about you, Jim?
I used to keep my lens hoods on 100% of the time, mostly really to protect the lens. But I mean, there definitely are a lot of situations where the light's just coming in just right and it really does just wreck the picture, or at least cause significant problems in it. A lack of contrast, lack of sharpness, and just kind of a haze over the picture when you get that coming in. Now, sometimes it's obvious and it's like, oh, you know, I really need the lens hood. But sometimes it's just a slight effect that you really don't notice until you look at it big and you realize, ooh, there was some light coming in on the sides. So if you use your lens hoods all the time, which really is best, then you really don't have to worry about that much. It's rare that you're going to have the problem. But it's not going to help you at all, you know, if you're shooting straight into sun. If it's sunrise and you're shooting, a landscape of the sunrise, well, the lens hood isn't going to do anything for you. The light is just going to stream right in the lens. But that's okay because the light is coming in the front of the lens. It's not, you know, kind of coming in at that weird angle. That's where it tends to cause the most problems, is where it's coming in from the side. However, when I switched to this new camera, I really wanted everything smaller and I got smaller bags and stuff. And sometimes the lens hoods just don't fit. And so lately I've been kind of leaving them off just because I want to be able to put everything in smaller bags and stuff. And then when I do have that issue where the light is kind of streaming, and I'll just put my hand up there and kind of block the light. So cool. I probably should have them on. It's better if you do, but if it doesn't fit in your bag or something, it's just not a big deal to just block the light.
So I guess that would be the point. There's no reason not to put them on. There's no downside, except I guess the bag factor. If you can't fit it in there, then that's a problem. But you may as well have them on. If you got it, put it on. There's no harm done by having it on there. And you might have a few cases where it saves the shot.
And plus, it just looks cool, right? Your lens looks better with a lens hood on.
You're more professional if you have a lens hood on your lens.
Okay, so I have a question from Erica. She asks about refurbished gear. She automatically sees that and thinks, no way. And she says, should I be considering buying refurbished camera bodies and stuff? Lenses, why or why not? So I've purchased a refurbished camera and had no problems with it until I let it fall off a cliff, and then I had problems with it.
That darn refurbished thing was such a ripoff.
And then suddenly I wanted my money back. But
you can't even take a cliff fall. My goodness.
The thing about refurbished gear,
so wimpy these days.
The thing about refurbished gear, though, is that you know at some point something went wrong with that particular lens, and a lot of times, or camera, and a lot of times they only fix what they have to in order to make it right. And so with lenses, like the value that you get from buying refurbished isn't enough for me to be like, I'll just buy it refurbished because the price difference isn't big enough. A lot of times with camera bodies, it is, especially if it's a really new model or something. So with camera bodies, I'm more likely to buy a refurbished body than I am a lens, because lens is going to hold its value longer. You might as well invest a little bit more and make sure you get a good one, because you're probably going to have that lens longer than your camera. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I have a little bit of a different take of it on it. A lot of times things are marked as refurbished because it's simply been purchased and returned.
Yeah,
so sometimes something was wrong with it, and sometimes it's just a return. It's just an open box. Somebody changed their mind and returned it. And I've had a lot of very good experiences buying refurbished. And recently I've had a very bad experience buying refurbished. I bought a lens that I was using the camera, and every once in a while I just get this intermittent error that it was just a general error I was getting. And I kept thinking, oh man, this camera's buggy. And I would use it, and then it would go away for a couple weeks and come back. And then it would start to get more and more frequent. And then I finally realized, oh, it's not the camera, it's the lens. I only get this error when I have this particular lens on. But because it was so intermittent, I just didn't notice it, that it was always that same lens. And it was a refurbished lens. And I realized that it had done it as soon as I got that lens. But for some reason, I just didn't connect the two because it was an intermittent issue. And so I got burned that time that it was refurbished. But I've bought probably dozens of things refurbished before, and usually I save a bunch of money. And so I guess my advice would be, yes, definitely go get it, but put it through its paces, really closely watching it for the first couple of weeks while you can still return it, mm-hmm. and make sure that you didn't get a lemon. But I've done it a lot of times and I've never had problems. This is the first time it's happened. So generally, I think it's a good buy.
So along the same lines, during this holiday season time, there's lots of deals that people are going to see. Lots of huge, deep discount kind of offerings, and people are looking to buy stuff. Camera gear, of course, as cheaply as you can. Spend as little money as possible to get it. And I had a friend of mine whose son wants to get into photography. And so she sent me a link. She said her son has been looking everywhere for a camera that she could get him that fits into a certain price range. And it was so low, I didn't think they had much hope of finding anything. It was like $300, I think. So he found one. He found a link. He found a site where they were offering a Canon camera with an 18 to 55 lens. It was the T5 for, I think it was $250. And she said, so is this a good deal? I was like, well, that looks great. Except I'd never heard of the site before. And when I went and checked out, like, they had all these graphics on there about protected by and validated by, and none of them worked. None of the links worked.
Oh,
and I'll bet if we called any of the numbers that were listed there, they either connected to someone that is faking it or they were disconnected. I didn't try it. I said, no, don't do this. It is not worth it to send these guys money. They could be legitimate. I don't know, but boy, it looks fishy. I wouldn't do it. And that's kind of I'd say if it's too good to be true, listeners, if it's way too good to be true, then it's too good to be true. Don't go for it. It was worth, we found something for about $100 more that was from Amazon. It is refurbished, but boy, with Amazon doing it, you know, you can return it, get your money back if you're not happy. So you have some recourse and something you can do. The other way, boy, you don't know if you might be sent an empty box or something or sent nothing. So be careful.
Yeah.
You definitely got to be careful with that. I'll bet a dozen times over the last couple of years, I've had listeners email me really upset because they found a great deal on a 5D Mark III or whatever camera that it was, you know, $1,000 cheaper. And they just got totally taken for their money. It's happened, I mean, a lot of times to listeners of the podcast that I've heard just really horrible stories on this. And so it's really to the point that I say, if you're not buying from a local place that you can, you know, take the camera with you after you buy, just buy from Amazon, Adorama, or B&H, and just pretty much stick there. Well, I'm sure there are other reputable camera stores. If there's a store that you know, you know, that's fine. But if you don't know a particular store that's safe, just stick with those, and you don't have to worry about it. It's just, the thing is, these cameras are all sold on MAP pricing. So they have a minimum advertised price. And so what price you see at one store, you're almost for sure going to see at the next store because they can't advertise it cheaper if it's a new camera. And so if you see a deal that's too good to be true on a new camera, it probably is because there's the minimum advertised price. They can't advertise it cheaper. For refurbished, for used, yeah, you can definitely find deals. But on new, it's pretty much going to be that price unless Canon or Nikon specifically is doing a sale.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got another one from Suzanne Silva, and it's a good one for this time of year. Any suggestions on photographing children in front of a Christmas tree? I have a nice 1.4 prime lens, and I don't want to shoot with a flash. They always come out blurry. I can't quite get them sharp enough. Any suggestions? So, Nick, what do you think?
It depends on how many kids, right? So if you're going to be shooting one kid, shoot wide open, you know, because if you're shooting with a wide open aperture, you're going to get really nice round bokeh balls. And that's what you're going for with that Christmas shot, right?
Yeah.
But if you have multiple kids, you're going to have to do one of two things. You're either going to have to stop down, or you're going to have to take great care to get their eyeballs on the exact same plane of focus. And mm-hmm. it's a lot easier just to stop down a little bit. The problem with that, though, is that you're going to lose those nice bokeh balls in the background. So in order to maintain that, you're going to have to put them further away from the tree and then get kind of closer to them and then trying to compose a shot with two kids in the shot and still some kind of background and getting all that out of focus. I think the easiest way is probably to use a longer lens if you can, because the longer your lens, the shallower your depth of field is going to be, and the easier that bokeh is going to be to get. And shoot wide open if you can. But if you got multiple people, you got to get them on the same plane of focus. That's what I would say.
Okay, but when you say stop down, what does that mean?
Okay. So that when I say stop down, that's photographer lingo for change your aperture. Instead of shooting at wide open, like a F1.4, stop down to like a F2.8 or F3.5 or even F4, depending on which camera, if you have a crop sensor or a full frame camera.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, I agree with everything Nick said, of course. It's just a difficult thing to do because you're trying to do a shallow depth of field shot, but with three kids. And so you're going to have to get them on exactly the same line. But there are ways that you can give yourself some leeway. Like when Nick was explaining about scooting away, that's really your very best bet for doing this, is you got to put those kids as far away from the Christmas tree as possible. And the reason that we're going to do that is it makes the background blurrier without going down to quite as low of an f-stop, because there's just a bigger difference behind there. The further they get away from the plane of focus, which is up on the kids, the more out of focus those lights on the Christmas tree are going to be. And then, like Nick said, you want to use a longer lens because you don't want to include so much of the room around it. You just want the Christmas tree in the back. You know, you don't want to need a bunch of room and then this tiny little pocket of lights. So that's the idea that you're going to have to do for this. One thing that I've done instead of this, if it's just too hard, is one, you could make a creative choice to just focus on one of the kids and have the others kind of out of focus or out playing in the background or something. Or two, just string up a bunch of Christmas lights all over the wall, and then you're going to have just this great bokeh of Christmas light, those little light mm-hmm. bursts that's beautiful. And forget about it being the Christmas tree shape. Just beautiful Christmas lights and the kids in the foreground. That's going to be a much, much, much more doable shot.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I wondered is if she was trying to capture them opening their gifts. And if that's the case, then there's not a problem with opening it wide and getting the shallow depth of field.
You're saying because you can focus on one kid.
Yeah, it's the one kid who's opening the gift at that moment. And then when the next kid's opening a gift, you get on them, you focus on them, and you can focus one at a time. And the other part that can be challenging, especially if you shoot a crop, is having enough space to actually have that long focal length lens and not have to try to get through the back wall of the room. You're often very limited in a constricted space to try to get these photos. And that's a really a tough challenge. Plus, there's the ambiance factor, too. Most of the time, people are trying like really hard to capture this beautiful low light Christmas tree this kind of scene, and that's just hard with the camera. It's really tough to get that right. Mm-hmm. So it may come down to ISO. You may have to live with a little grain if you want to try to capture it, because you're going to need to have a shutter speed that's probably, I'd start with at least double your focal length, whatever your max focal length is on the lens.
Very cool. Well, I got a question here about how to stay warm while doing photography. And this is very timely for two reasons. One is I'm headed to Yellowstone in a couple weeks to do a free photography workshop with a bunch of you there. And also, I announced a workshop in Iceland coming up in April. You can find all the details about that at improvephotography.com/Iceland. And that one's going to be really inexpensive for a photography workshop. I've seen Iceland workshops going at over $10,000. And we're going to do this one, Improve Photography style, very reasonably priced. And we're going to find some accommodations that we can all kind of split rooms and stuff. So check that out at improvephotography.com/Iceland. But I've been thinking about the cold as well, because no matter what time of year you are there, it just gets really, really windy. And the wind is the worst thing for when you're standing out a long time trying to take pictures. It doesn't even have to be very cold. If it's blowing through your coat, it's just going to be freezing. So usually what I do is I have a very lightweight down jacket that I wear under as my base layer, and then just a raincoat on top of that. Raincoat is great whether it's raining or not, because it cuts the wind, because you know it has those taped seams, and so no wind is going to get through it at all. And so you have your warming layer underneath, and then you block the wind on the outside, and that usually keeps me really warm. What do you guys do for shooting in the cold?
Yeah, it's all about layers. The more layers you have, the more versatile your setup's going to be. You can always take a layer off if you get too hot. So I usually start with some kind of undershirt, and then some kind of long sleeve shirt over that, and then some kind of little like pullover, you know, soft pullover thingamajiggy over that, and then some kind of coat over that. And a lot of times that's overkill, but I would much rather be a little bit too warm than just freezing. Another thing that I really love, and I know I've talked about these before, but they're the
aqua. I knew you were going to bring them.
No, it's not my knee high socks. It's not my socks. It's my Aquatech sensory gloves. So they are winter gloves, where you can poke your pointer finger and poke your thumb out of little special designed holes, and then you can operate your camera, and then you can tuck your fingers away and you have warm hands again. So I think they run like $30, but they're well worth the investment. So those in conjunction with some layers, and you got to get one of those awesome fur lined hats that like you always picture the typical Canadian wearing, you know what I'm talking about? Like with the thing
and the red plaid that could cover your ears. Well, no,
or like the really fashionable leather, and you can look like some kind of aviator guy. You know what I'm talking
about. Okay. Well, I'm excited to talk about gloves. I'm glad you brought it up, Nick, because for the first time ever, there is a Kickstarter that I can actually back. I know. I am usually never very excited by them, but this one has definitely got my support. It is, you can find it at photographygloves.com. Photographygloves.com. This is a listener to the Improved Photography Podcast that started this and sent me some of these, and they are awesome. I've been wearing them around all around the house this week because they're just cool. They sent me some to try out, and like, I know it's just a glove, but like they really are comfortable, and they're really well designed for photography for two reasons. One, it has those tips, you know, the fingertips that you can remove out to do stuff on the camera, but it's just with your first two fingers that you would actually need for doing buttons. All the others don't remove the fingertips so that they actually stay warm. And they're made out of really good materials. Like it's like part neoprene, but the problem is if you have too much neoprene, it just starts to it doesn't breathe enough, and it gets the gloves stink after a while. And so these have different materials so that they can kind of breathe and stay warm, and they look cool, and they have a little pocket to put an SD card in there. Oh, nice. So that as you run out of a battery or an SD card while you're shooting, you don't have to take it out of the bag. It's right there on your gloves. You can just make the quick switch. So it actually is pretty darn cool. I'm very happy with it. It is at photographygloves.com, and you can find that on Kickstarter right now. There are 18 days to go. It really is pretty cool, and it's by a listener of the podcast, so pretty neat.
That is cool.
So the Valerit photography gloves are my doodad of the week. Nick and Jeff, what do you guys have?
So I have the, it's made by Sunwave Photo. It's a, I'm not sure what it's really called. It's the Duo Lever Clamp Arca Swiss compatible Arca clamp thingamajig. How many times in this episode have I said the thingamajig? But it's because my mind isn't as doesn't keep up. But anyways, so it's basically just a replacement top for your ball head, where instead of having the little screw thing, I am just awesome at describing things today. Instead of instead of having the little twisty thing that you have to undo to remove your quick release plate, it has just a quick lever, and you flip the lever over, it comes undone, you put it back on, you flip the lever again, and it's tight. It's like a $45 thing, but it's totally changed how I use my ball head. Like, I went from dropping cameras down a cliff to actually knowing that my camera is secure, and it's quicker, and it's better, and I really like it. And it's made by Sunwave Photo. It's the Duo Lever Clamp Arca Swiss compatible thingamajig.
Very cool. I would love it. That's a very nice thingamajig you got there.
Okay, so for me, I'm going to tell you what's on my wish list. So I don't have experience with it yet, but I have some canvas kind of backdrop stuff I bought a while ago at a garage sale. And they've been sitting inside this, like three of them, and they've been sitting inside a bag forever. But I really want to get them out because I have an idea for a family photo shoot I want to do. And I have nothing to hang them on. So what I want is some stands that I can put up and hang these backdrops on. And I'm looking at something that's called the Impact Background Support System. That's 12 feet wide for $100 on Amazon. And I think I'm going to get those so that I can try this out, my experiment with a family photo shoot.
Okay. I own that. And it really is very well made. You'll like it. Well, thank you everybody for joining us on this episode of the Improved Photography Podcast, and we'll see you in another 7 days.